from a human being into an organ-stop or something of the sort. For what is a man without desires, without free will, and without choice, if not a stop in an organ? What do you think? Let us reckon the chances. Can such a thing happen or not? You decide. Our choice is usually mistaken from a false view of our advantage. We sometimes choose absolute nonsense because in our foolishness we see in that nonsense the easiest means for attaining a supposed advantage. But when all that is explained and worked out on paper, which is perfectly possible, for it is contemptible and senseless to suppose that some laws of nature man will never understand, then certainly so-called desires will no longer exist. For if a desire should come into conflict with reason, we shall then reason and not desire, because it will be impossible retaining our reason to be senseless in our desires, and in that way knowingly act against reason and desire to injure ourselves. And as all choice and reasoning can be really calculated, because there will some day be discovered the laws of our so-called free will, so, joking apart, there may, one day, be something like a table constructed of them, so that we really shall choose in accordance with it. If, for instance, some day they calculate and prove to me that I made a long nose at someone, because I could not help making a long nose at him, and that I had to do it in that particular way, what freedom is left to me, especially if I am a learned man and have taken my degree somewhere? Then I should be able to calculate my whole life for 30 years beforehand. In short, if this could be arranged, there would be nothing left for us to do. Anyway, we should have to understand that. And, in fact, we ought unwearyingly to repeat to ourselves that at such and such a time and such circumstances, nature does not ask our leave, that we have got to take her as she is, and not fashion her to suit our fancy. And if we really aspire to formulas and tables of rules, and, well, even to the chemical retort, there's no help for it. We must accept the retort, too, or else it will be accepted without our consent. Yes, but here I come to a stop. Gentlemen, you must excuse me for being over-philosophical. It's the result of 40 years underground. Allow me to indulge my fancy. You see, gentlemen, reason is an excellent thing. There's no disputing that. But reason is nothing but reason, and satisfies only the rational side of man's nature, while will is a manifestation of the whole life, that is, of the whole human life, including reason and all the impulses. And although our life, in this manifestation of it, is often worthless, yet it is life, and not simply extracting square roots. Here I, for instance, quite naturally want to live, in order to satisfy all my capacities for life, and not simply my capacity for reasoning, that is, not simply 1/20th of my capacity for life. What does reason know? Reason only knows what it has succeeded in learning. Some things, perhaps, it will never learn. That is a poor comfort. But why not say so frankly? And human nature acts as a whole, with everything that is in it, consciously or unconsciously, and even if it goes wrong, it lives. I suspect, gentlemen, that you are looking at me with compassion. You tell me again that an enlightened and developed man, such, in short, as the future man will be, cannot consciously desire anything disadvantaged to himself, but that can be proved mathematically. I thoroughly agree, it can, by mathematics, but I repeat for the 100th time, there is one case, one only, when man may consciously, purposely, desire what is injurious to himself, what is stupid, very stupid, simply in order to have the right to desire for himself even what is very stupid, and not to be bound by an obligation to desire only what is sensible. Of course, this very stupid thing, this caprice of ours, may be in reality, gentlemen, more advantageous for us than anything else on earth, especially in certain cases. And in particular, it may be more advantageous than any advantage even when it does us obvious harm, and contradicts the soundest conclusions of our reason concerning our advantage, for in any circumstances it preserves for us what is most precious and most important, that is, our personality, our individuality. Some, you see, maintain that this really is the most precious thing for mankind. Choice can, of course, if it chooses, be in agreement with reason, and especially if this be not absurd but kept within bounds. It is profitable, and sometimes even praiseworthy. But very often, and even most often, choice is utterly and stubbornly opposed to reason. And do you know that that, too, is profitable, sometimes even praiseworthy? Gentlemen, let us suppose that man is not stupid. Indeed, one cannot refuse to suppose that, if only from the one consideration that if man is stupid, then who is wise? But if he is not stupid, he is monstrously ungrateful, phenomenally ungrateful. In fact, I believe that the best definition of man is the ungrateful biped. But that is not all. That is not his worst defect. His worst defect is his perpetual moral obliquity. Perpetual, from the days of the flood to the Schleswig-Holstein period. Moral obliquity and consequently lack of good sense, for it has long been accepted that lack of good sense is due to no other cause than moral obliquity. But put it to the test and cast your eyes upon the history of mankind. What will you see? Is it a grand spectacle? Grand, if you like. Take the Colossus of Rhodes, for instance. That's worth something. With good reason, Mr. Anyevsky testifies of it that some say that it is the work of man's hands, while others maintain that it has been created by nature herself. Is it many-colored? Maybe it is many-colored, too, if one takes the dress uniforms, military and civilian, of all peoples in all ages. That alone is worth something, and if you take the undress uniforms, you will never get to the end of it. No historian would be equal to the job. Is it monotonous? Maybe it's monotonous, too. It's fighting and fighting. They are fighting now. They fought first and they fought last. You will admit that it is almost too monotonous. In short, one may say anything about the history of the world, anything that might enter the most disordered imagination. The only thing one can't say is that it's rational. The very word sticks in one's throat. And indeed, this is the odd thing that is continually happening. There are continually turning up in life moral and rational persons, sages and lovers of humanity, who make it their object to live all their lives as morally and rationally as possible, to be, so to speak, a light to their neighbors, simply in order to show them that it is possible to live morally and rationally in this world. And yet we all know that those very people sooner or later have been false to themselves, playing some queer trick, often a most unseemly one. Now, I ask you, what can be expected of man since he is a being endowed with strange qualities? Shower upon him every earthly blessing, drown him in a sea of happiness, so that nothing but bubbles of bliss can be seen on the surface. Give him economic prosperity, such that he should have nothing else to do but sleep, eat cakes, and busy himself with the continuation of his species. And even then, out of sheer ingratitude, sheer spite, man would play you some nasty trick. He would even risk his cakes, and would deliberately desire the most fatal rubbish, the most uneconomical absurdity, simply to introduce into all this positive good sense his fatal, fantastic element. It is just his fantastic dreams, his vulgar folly, that he will desire to retain, simply in order to prove to himself, as though that were so necessary, that men still are men, and not the keys of a piano, which the laws of nature threaten to control so completely that soon one will be able to desire nothing but by the calendar. And that is not all. Even if man really were nothing but a piano key, even if this were proved to him by natural science and mathematics, even then he would not become reasonable, but would purposely do something perverse out of simple ingratitude, simply to gain his point. And if he does not find means, he will contrive destruction and chaos, will contrive sufferings of all sorts, only to gain his point. He will launch a curse upon the world, and as only man can curse, it is his privilege, the primary distinction between him and other animals. May be by his curse alone he will attain his object, that is, convince himself that he is a man and not a piano key. If you say that all this, too, can be calculated and tabulated, chaos and darkness and curses, so that the mere possibility of calculating it all beforehand would stop it all and reason would reassert itself, then man would purposely go mad in order to be rid of reason and gain his point. I believe in it, I answer for it, for the whole work of man really seems to consist in nothing but proving to himself every minute that he is a man and not a piano key. It may be at the cost of his skin, it may be by cannibalism. And this being so, can one help being tempted to rejoice that it is not yet come off, and that desire still depends on something we don't know? You can scream at me, that is, if you condescend to do so, that no one is touching my free will, that all they are concerned with is that my free will should of itself, of its own free will, coincide with my own normal interests, with the laws of nature and arithmetic. Good heavens, gentlemen, what sort of free will is left when we come to tabulation and arithmetic, when it will all be a case of twice two make four? Twice two makes four without my will, as if free will meant that. 9. Gentlemen, I am joking, and I know myself that my jokes are not brilliant, but you know one can take everything as a joke. I am, perhaps, jesting against the grain. Gentlemen, I am tormented by questions. Answer them for me. You, for instance, want to cure men of their old habits and reform their will in accordance with science and good sense. But how do you know not only that it is possible, but also that it is desirable to reform man in that way? And what leads you to the conclusion that man's inclinations need reforming? In short, how do you know that such a reformation will be a benefit to man? And to go to the root of the matter, why are you so positively convinced that not to act against his real normal interests, guaranteed by the conclusions of reason and arithmetic, is certainly always advantageous for man and must always be a law for mankind? So far, you know, this is only your supposition. It may be the law of logic, but not the law of humanity. You think, gentlemen, perhaps, that I am mad. Allow me to defend myself. I agree that man is preeminently a creative animal, predestined to strive consciously for an object and to engage in engineering, that is, incessantly and eternally to make new roads, wherever they may lead. But the reason why he wants sometimes to go off at a tangent may just be that he is predestined to make the road, and perhaps, too, that however stupid the direct practical man might be, the thought sometimes will occur to him that the road almost always does lead somewhere, and that the destination it leads to is less important than the process of making it, and that the chief thing is to save the well-conducted child from despising engineering and so giving way to the fatal idleness which, as we all know, is the mother of all the vices. Man likes to make roads and to create. That is a fact beyond dispute. But why has he such a passionate love for destruction and chaos also? Tell me that. But on that point I want to say a couple of words myself. May it not be that he loves chaos and destruction? There can be no disputing that he does sometimes love it, because he is instinctively afraid of attaining his object and completing the edifice he is constructing. Who knows? Perhaps he only loves that edifice from a distance, and is by no means in love with it at close quarters. Perhaps he only loves building it and does not want to live in it, but will leave it, when completed, for the use of les animaux domestiques, such as the ants, the sheep, and so on. Now the ants have quite a different taste. They have a marvelous edifice of that pattern which endures forever, the ant heap. With the ant heap the respectable race of ants began, and with the ant heap they will probably end, which does the greatest credit to their perseverance and good sense. But man is a frivolous and incongruous creature, and perhaps, like a chess player, loves the process of the game, not the end of it. And who knows? There is no saying with certainty. Perhaps the only goal on earth to which mankind is striving lies in this incessant process of attaining. In other words, in life itself, and not in the thing to be attained, which must always be expressed as a formula, as positive as 2 × 2 = 4. And such positiveness is not life, gentlemen, but is the beginning of death. Anyway, man has always been afraid of this mathematical certainty, and I am afraid of it now. Granted that man does nothing but seek that mathematical certainty, he traverses oceans, sacrifices his life in the quest, but to succeed, really to find it, dreads, I assure you. He feels that when he has found it, there will be nothing for him to look for. When workmen have finished their work day, they do at least receive their pay. They go to the tavern. Then they are taken to the police station, and there is occupation for a week. But where can man go? Anyway, one can observe a certain awkwardness about him when he has attained such objects. He loves the process of attaining, but does not quite like to have attained. And that, of course, is very absurd. In fact, man is a comical creature. There seems to be a kind of jest in it all. But yet, mathematical certainty is, after all, something insufferable. 2 × 2 = 4 seems to me simply a piece of insolence. 2 × 2 = 4 is a pert coxcomb who stands with arms akimbo, barring your path and spitting. I admit that 2 × 2 = 4 is an excellent thing. But if we are to give everything its due, 2 × 2 = 5 is sometimes a very charming thing, too. And why are you so firmly, so triumphantly convinced that only the normal and the positive, in other words, only what is conducive to welfare, is for the advantage of man? Is not reason in error as regards advantage? Does not man, perhaps, love something besides well-being? Perhaps he is just as fond of suffering. Perhaps suffering is just a greater benefit to him as well-being. Man is sometimes extraordinarily, passionately in love with suffering, and that is a fact. There is no need to appeal to universal history to prove that. Only ask yourself if you are a man and have lived at all. As far as my personal opinion is concerned, to care only for well-being seems to me positively ill-bred. Whether it's good or bad, it is sometimes very pleasant, too, to smash things. I hold no brief for suffering, nor for well-being either. I am standing for my caprice, and for its being guaranteed to me when necessary. Suffering should be out of place in vaudevilles, for instance. I know that. In the Palace of Crystal it is unthinkable. Suffering means doubt, negation. And what would be the good of a palace of crystal if there could be any doubt about it? And yet I think man will never renounce real suffering, that is, destruction and chaos. Why, suffering is the sole origin of consciousness. Though I did lay it down at the beginning that consciousness is the greatest misfortune for man, yet I know man prizes it, and would not give it up for any satisfaction. Consciousness, for instance, is infinitely superior to 2 × 2 = 4. Once you have mathematical certainty, there is nothing left to do or to understand. There will be nothing left but to bottle up your 5 senses and plunge into contemplation. While, if you stick to consciousness, even though the same result is attained, you can at least flog yourself at times, and that will, at any rate, liven you up. Reactionary as it is, corporal punishment is better than nothing. 10. You believe in a palace of crystal that could never be destroyed, a palace that which one will not be able to put out one's tongue or make a long nose on the sly. And perhaps that is just why I am afraid of this edifice, that it is of crystal and can never be destroyed, and that one cannot put one's tongue out at it even on the sly. You see, if it were not a palace but a hen-house, I might creep into it to avoid getting wet. And yet I would not call the hen-house a palace out of gratitude to it for keeping me dry. You laugh and say that in such circumstances a hen-house is as good as a mansion. Yes, I answer, if one had to live simply to keep out of the rain. But what is to be done if I have taken it into my head that that is not the only object in life, and that if one must live, one had better live in a mansion? That is my choice, my desire. You will only eradicate it when you have changed my preference. Well, do change it. Allure me with something else. Give me another ideal. But meanwhile, I will not take a hen-house for a mansion. The palace of crystal may be an idle dream. It may be that it is inconsistent with the laws of nature, and that I have invented it only through my own stupidity, through the old-fashioned irrational habits of my generation. But what does it matter to me that it is inconsistent? That makes no difference, since it exists in my desires, or rather exists as long as my desires exist. Perhaps you are laughing again. Laugh away. I will put up with any mockery rather than pretend that I am satisfied when I am hungry. I know anyway that I will not be put off with a compromise, with a recurring zero, simply because it is consistent with the laws of nature and actually exists. I will not accept as the crown of my desires a block of buildings with tenements for the poor on a lease of 1,000 years, and perhaps with a signboard of a dentist hanging out. Destroy my desires, eradicate my ideals, show me something better, and I will follow you. You will say, perhaps, that it is not worth your trouble. But in that case I can give you the same answer. We are discussing things seriously. But if you won't deign to give me your attention, I will drop your acquaintance. I can retreat into my underground hole. But while I am alive and have desires, I would rather my hand were withered off than bring one brick to such a building. Don't remind me that I have just rejected the palace of crystal for the sole reason that one cannot put out one's tongue at it. I did not say because I am so fond of putting my tongue out. Perhaps the thing I resented was that of all your edifices there has not been one at which one could not put out one's tongue. On the contrary, I would let my tongue be cut off out of gratitude if things could be so arranged that I should lose all desire to put it out. It is not my fault that things cannot be so arranged, and that one must be satisfied with model flats. Then why am I made with such desires? Can I have been constructed simply in order to come to the conclusion that all my construction is a cheat? Can this be my whole purpose? I do not believe it. But do you know what? I am convinced that we underground folk ought to be kept on a curb, that we may sit 40 years underground without speaking. When we do come out into the light of day and break out, we talk and talk and talk. 11. The long and short of it is, gentlemen, that it is better to do nothing, better conscious inertia, and so hurrah for underground. Though I have said that I envy the normal man to the last drop of my bile, yet I shall not care to be in his place, such as he is now, though I shall not cease envying him. No, no. Anyway, the underground life is more advantageous. There, at any rate, one can... Oh, but even now I am lying. I am lying because I know myself that it is not underground that is better, but something different, quite different, for which I am thirsting, but which I cannot find. Damn underground! I will tell you another thing that would be better, and that is, if I myself believed in anything of what I have just written, I swear to you, gentlemen, there is not one thing, not one word of what I have written that I really believe. That is, I believe it, perhaps, but at the same time I feel and suspect that I am lying like a cobbler. Then why have you written all this? You will say to me. I ought to put you underground for 40 years without anything to do, and then come to you in your cellar to find out what stage you have reached. How can a man be left with nothing to do for 40 years? Isn't that shameful? Isn't that humiliating? You will say, perhaps, wagging your heads contemptuously. You thirst for life, and try to settle the problems of life by a logical tangle. And how persistent, how insolent are your sallies, and at the same time what a scare you are in. You talk nonsense and are pleased with it. You say impudent things and are in continual alarm and apologizing for them. You declare that you are afraid of nothing, and at the same time try to ingratiate yourself in our good opinion. You declare that you are gnashing your teeth, and at the same time you try to be witty so as to amuse us. You know that your witticisms are not witty, but you are evidently well satisfied with your literary value. You may, perhaps, have really suffered, but you have no respect for your own suffering. You may have sincerity, but you have no modesty. Out of your pettiest vanity you expose your sincerity to publicity and ignominy. You doubtlessly mean to say something, but hide your last word through fear, because you have not the resolution to utter it, and only have a cowardly impudence. You boast of consciousness, but you are not sure of your ground, for though your mind works, yet your heart is darkened and corrupt, and you cannot have a full, genuine consciousness without a pure heart. And how intrusive you are, how you insist and grimace. Lies, lies, lies. Of course, I have myself made up all the things you say. That, too, is from underground. I have been for 40 years listening to you through a crack under the floor. I have invented them myself. There was nothing else I could invent. It is no wonder that I have learnt it by heart, and it has taken a literary form. But can you really be so credulous as to think that I will print all this and give it to you to read, too? And another problem. Why do I call you gentlemen? Why do I address you as though you really were my readers? Such confessions as I intend to make are never printed, nor given to other people to read. Anyway, I am not strong-minded enough for that, and I don't see why I should be. But, you see, a fancy has occurred to me, and I want to realize it at all costs. Let me explain. Every man has reminiscences which he would not tell to everyone, but only to his friends. He has other matters in his mind which he would not reveal even to his friends, but only to himself, and that in secret. But there are other things which a man is afraid to tell even to himself, and every decent man has a number of such things stored away in his mind. The more decent he is, the greater the number of such things in his mind. Anyway, I have only lately determined to remember some of my early adventures. Till now I have always avoided them, even with a certain uneasiness. Now, when I am not only recalling them, but have actually decided to write an account of them, I want to try the experiment whether one can, even with oneself, be perfectly open and not take fright at the whole truth. I will observe, in parentheses, that Heine says that a true autobiography is almost an impossibility, and that man is bound to lie about himself. He considers that Rousseau certainly told lies about himself and his confessions, and even intentionally lied out of vanity. I am convinced that Heine is right. I quite understand how sometimes one may, out of sheer vanity, attribute regular crimes to oneself, and indeed I can very well conceive that kind of vanity. But Heine judged of people who made their confessions to the public. I write only for myself, and I wish to declare once and for all that if I write as though I were addressing readers, that is simply because it is easier for me to write in that form. It is a form, an empty form. I shall never have readers, I have made this plain already. I don't wish to be hampered by any restrictions in the compilation of my notes. I shall not attempt any system or method. I will jot things down as I remember them. But here, perhaps, someone will catch at the word and ask me, if you really don't reckon on readers, why do you make such compacts with yourself, and on paper, too? That is, that you won't attempt any system or method, that you jot things down as you remember them, and so on and so on. Why are you explaining? Why do you apologize? Well, there it is, I answer. There is a whole psychology in this, though. Perhaps it is simply that I am a coward, and perhaps that I purposely imagine an audience before me in order that I may be more dignified while I write. There are perhaps thousands of reasons. Again, what is the object precisely in writing? If it is not to be for the benefit of the public, why should I not simply recall these incidents in my own mind without putting them on paper? Quite so, but yet it is more imposing on paper. There is something more impressive in it. I shall be better able to criticize myself and improve my style. Besides, I shall perhaps obtain actual relief from writing. Today, for instance, I am particularly oppressed by one memory of a distant past. It came back vividly to my mind a few days ago, and has remained haunting me like an annoying tune that one cannot get rid of. And yet I must get rid of it somehow. I have hundreds of such reminiscences, but at times some one stands out from the hundred and oppresses me. For some reason, I believe that if I write it down, I should get rid of it. Why not try? Besides, I am bored, and I never have anything to do. Writing will be a sort of work. They say work makes man kind-hearted and honest. Well, here's a chance for me, anyway. Snow is falling today, yellow and dingy. It fell yesterday, too, and a few days ago. I fancy it is the wet snow that has reminded me of that incident which I cannot shake off now. And so let it be a story apropos of the falling snow. End of Underground, Part 2.
Notes from the Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Apropos of the Wet Snow, Part 1. When, from dark error's subjugation, my words of passionate exhortation had wrenched thy fainting spirit free, and writhing prone in thine affliction, thou didst recall with malediction the vice that had encompassed thee, and when thy slumbering conscience, fretting by recollection's torturing flame, thou didst reveal the hideous setting of thy life's current ere I came, when suddenly I saw thee sicken, and weeping, hide thine anguished face, revolted, maddened, horror-stricken, at memories of foul disgrace. Nekrasov. 1. At that time I was only 24. My life was even then gloomy, ill-regulated, and as solitary as that of a savage. I made friends with no one, and positively avoided talking, and buried myself more and more in my hole. At work in the office, I never looked at anyone, and was perfectly well aware that my companions looked upon me, not only as a queer fellow, but even looked upon me, I always fancied this, with a sort of loathing. I sometimes wondered why it was that nobody except me fancied that he was looked upon with aversion. One of the clerks had a most repulsive, pock-marked face, which looked positively villainous. I believe I should not have dared to look at any one with such an unsightly countenance. Another one had such a very dirty old uniform that there was an unpleasant odor in his proximity. Yet not one of these gentlemen showed the slightest self-consciousness, either about their clothes or their countenance or their character in any way. Neither of them ever imagined that they were looked at with repulsion. If they had imagined it, they would not have minded, so long as their superiors did not look at them in that way. It is clear to me now that, owing to my unbounded vanity and to the high standard I set for myself, I often looked at myself with furious discontent, which verged on loathing. and so I inwardly attributed the same feeling to everyone. I hated my face, for instance. I thought it disgusting, and even suspected that there was something base in my expression, and so every day when I turned up at the office I tried to behave as independently as possible and to assume a lofty expression so that I might not be suspected of being abject. My face may be ugly, I thought, but let it be lofty, expressive, and above all, extremely intelligent. But I was positively and painfully certain that it was impossible for my countenance ever to express those qualities. And what was worst of all, I thought it actually stupid-looking, and I would have been quite satisfied if I could have looked intelligent. In fact, I would even have put up with looking base if, at the same time, my face could have been thought strikingly intelligent. Of course, I hated my fellow clerks, one and all, and I despised them all. Yet, at the same time, I was, as it were, afraid of them. In fact, it happened at times that I thought more highly of them than of myself. It somehow happened quite suddenly that I alternated between despising them and thinking them superior to myself. A cultivated and decent man cannot be vain without setting a fearfully high standard for himself, and without despising and almost hating himself at certain moments. But whether I despised them or thought them superior, I dropped my eyes almost every time I met anyone. I even made experiments whether I could face so-and-so's looking at me, and I was always the first to drop my eyes. This worried me to distraction. I had a sickly dread, too, of being ridiculous, and so had a slavish passion for the conventional in everything external. I loved to fall into the common rut, and had a whole-hearted terror of any kind of eccentricity in myself. But how could I live up to it? I was morbidly sensitive, as a man of our age should be. They were all stupid, and as like one another as so many sheep. Perhaps I was the only one in the office who fancied that I was a coward and a slave, and I fancied it just because I was more highly developed. But it was not only that I fancied it. It really was so. I was a coward and a slave. And I say this without the slightest embarrassment. Every decent man of our age must be a coward and a slave. That is his normal condition. Of that I am firmly persuaded. He is made and constructed to that very end, and not only at the present time, owing to some casual circumstances, but always, at all times, a decent man is bound to be a coward and a slave. It is the law of nature for all decent people all over the earth. If any one of them happens to be valiant about something, he need not be comforted nor carried away by that. He would show the white feather just the same before something else. That is how it invariably and inevitably ends. Only donkeys and mules are valiant, and they only till they are pushed up to the wall. It is not worth while to pay attention to them, for they really are of no consequence. Another circumstance, too, worried me in those days, that there was no one like me, and I was unlike anyone else. I am alone, and they are everyone, I thought, and pondered. From that it is evident that I was still a youngster. The very opposite sometimes happened. It was loathsome sometimes to go to the office. Things reached such a point that I often came home ill. But all at once, apropos of nothing, there would come a phase of skepticism and indifference. Everything happened in phases to me, and I would laugh myself at my intolerance and fastidiousness. I would reproach myself with being romantic. At one time I was unwilling to speak to anyone, while at other times I would not only talk, but go to the length of contemplating making friends with them. All my fastidiousness would suddenly, for no rhyme or reason, vanish. Who knows, perhaps I never really had it, and it had simply been affected and got out of books. I have not decided that question even now. Once I quite made friends with them, visited their homes, played preference, drank vodka, talked of promotions. But here, let me make a digression. We Russians, speaking generally, have never had those foolish transcendental romantics, German, and still more French, on whom nothing produces any effect. If there were an earthquake, if all France perished at the barricades, they would still be the same. They would not even have the decency to affect a change, but would still go on singing their transcendental songs to the hour of their death, because they are fools. We in Russia have no fools. That is well known. That is what distinguishes us from foreign lands. Consequently, these transcendental natures are not found amongst us in their pure form. The idea that they are is due to our realistic journalists and critics of that day, always on the lookout for Konstantinoglus and Uncle Pyotr Ivanitch's, and foolishly accepting them as our ideal. They have slandered our romantics, taking them for the same transcendental sort as in Germany or France. On the contrary, the characteristics of our romantics are absolutely and directly opposed to the transcendental European type, and no European standard can be applied to them. Allow me to make use of this word romantic, an old-fashioned and much-respected word which has done good service and is familiar to all. The characteristics of our romantic are to understand everything, to see everything, and to see it often incomparably more clearly than our most realistic minds see it. To refuse to accept anyone or anything, but at the same time not to despise anything. To give way, to yield from policy, never to lose sight of a useful practical object, such as rent-free quarters at the government expense, pensions, decorations, to keep their eye on that object through all the enthusiasms and volumes of lyrical poems, and at the same time to preserve the sublime and the beautiful inviolates within them at the hour of their death, and to preserve themselves also, incidentally, like some precious jewel wrapped in cotton wool, if only for the benefit of the sublime and the beautiful. Our romantic is a man of great breadth, and the greatest rogue of all our rogues, I assure you. I can assure you from experience, indeed. Of course, that is, if he is intelligent. But what am I saying? The romantic is always intelligent, and I only meant to observe that although we have had foolish romantics, they don't count, and they were only so because in the flower of their youth they degenerated into Germans, and to preserve their precious jewel more comfortably, settled somewhere out there, by preference in Weimar or the Black Forest. I, for instance, genuinely despise my official work, and did not openly abuse it simply because I was in it myself and got a salary for it. Anyway, take note, I did not openly abuse it. Our romantic would rather go out of his mind, a thing, however, which very rarely happens, than to take open abuse, unless he had some other career in view, and he is never kicked out. At most, they would take him to the lunatic asylum as the King of Spain, if he should go very mad. But it is only the thin, fair people who go out of their minds in Russia. Innumerable romantics attain later in life in considerable rank in the service. Their many-sidedness is remarkable, and what a faculty they have for the most contradictory sensations. I was comforted by this thought, even in those days, and I am of the same opinion now. That is why there are so many broad natures among us who never lose their ideal, even in the depths of degradation, and though they never stir a finger for their ideal, though they are errant thieves and knaves, yet they tearfully cherish their first ideal and are extraordinarily honest at heart. Yes, it is only among us that the most incorrigible rogue can be absolutely and loftily honest at heart, without in the least ceasing to be a rogue. I repeat, our romantics frequently become such accomplished rascals, I use the term rascals affectionately, suddenly display such a sense of reality and practical knowledge that their bewildered superiors and the public generally can only ejaculate in amazement.
Their many-sidedness is really amazing, and goodness knows what it may develop into later on, and what the future has in store for us. It is not a poor material. I do not say this from any foolish or boastful patriotism, but I feel sure that you are again imagining that I am joking. Or perhaps it's just the contrary, and you are convinced that I really think so. Anyway, gentlemen, I shall welcome both views as an honor and a special favor. And do forgive my digression. I did not, of course, maintain friendly relations with my comrades, and soon was at loggerheads with them, and in my youth and inexperience I even gave up bowing to them, as though I had cut off all relations. That, however, only happened to me once. As a rule, I was always alone. In the first place, I spent most of my time at home, reading. I tried to stifle all that was continually seething within me by means of external impressions, and the only external means I had was reading. Reading, of course, was a great help, exciting me, giving me pleasure and pain, but at times it bored me fearfully. One longed for movement in spite of everything, and I plunged all, at once, into dark, underground, loathsome vice of the pettiest kind. My wretched passions were acute, smarting from my continual sickly irritability. I had hysterical impulses, with tears and convulsions. I had no resource except reading. That is, there was nothing in my surroundings which I could respect and which attracted me. I was overwhelmed with depression, too. I had an hysterical craving for incongruity and for contrast, and so I took to vice. I have not said all this to justify myself, but no, I am lying. I did want to justify myself. I make that little observation for my own benefit, gentlemen. I don't want to lie. I vowed to myself I would not. And so, furtively, timidly, in solitude, at night, I indulged in filthy vice with a feeling of shame which never deserted me, even at the most loathsome moments, and which at some moments nearly made me curse. Already, even then, I had my underground world in my soul. I was fearfully afraid of being seen, of being met, of being recognized. I visited various obscure haunts. One night, as I was passing a tavern, I saw through a lighted window some gentlemen fighting with billiard cues, and I saw one of them thrown out of the window. At other times I should have felt very much disgusted, but I was in such a mood at the time that I actually envied the gentleman thrown out of the window, and I envied him so much that I even went into the tavern and into the billiard room. Perhaps, I thought, I'll have a fight, too, and they'll throw me out of the window. I was not drunk, but what is one to do? Depression will drive a man to such a pitch of hysteria. But nothing happened. It seemed that I was not even equal to being thrown out of the window, and I went away without having my fight. An officer put me in my place from the first moment. I was standing by the billiard table, and in my ignorance blocking up the way, and he wanted to pass. He took me by the shoulders, and without a word, without a warning or explanation, moved me from where I was standing to another spot and passed by, as though he had not noticed me. I could have forgiven blows, but I could not forgive his having moved me without noticing me. Devil knows what I would have given for a real regular quarrel, a more decent, a more literary one, so to speak. I had been treated like a fly. The officer was over 6 foot, while I was a spindly little fellow. But the quarrel was in my hands. I had only to protest, and I certainly would have been thrown out of the window. But I changed my mind and preferred to beat a resentful retreat. I went out of the tavern, straight home, confused and troubled,
and the next night I went out again with the same lewd intentions, still more furtively, abjectly, and miserably than before, as it were, with tears in my eyes. But still I did go out again. Don't imagine, though, it was cowardice made me slink away from the officer. I never have been a coward at heart, though I have always been a coward in action. But don't be in a hurry to laugh. I assure you I can explain it all. Ah, if only that officer had been one of the sort who would consent to fight a duel. But no, he was one of those gentlemen, alas, long extinct, who preferred fighting with cues, or, like Gogol's Lieutenant Pirogov, appealing to the police. They did not fight duels, and would have thought a duel with a civilian like me an utterly unseemly procedure in any case. And they looked upon the duel altogether as something impossible, something free-thinking and French. But they were quite ready to bully, especially when they were over 6 foot. I did not slink away through cowardice, but through an unbounded vanity. I was afraid not of his 6 foot, not of getting a sound thrashing and being thrown out of the window. I should have had physical courage enough, I assure you, but I had not the moral courage. What I was afraid of was that everyone present, from the insolent marker down to the lowest little stinking pimply clerk in a greasy collar, would jeer at me and fail to understand when I began to protest and address them in literary language. For of the point of honour, not of honour, but of the point of honour, point d'honneur, one cannot speak among us except in literary language. You can't allude to the point of honour in ordinary language. I was fully convinced, this sense of reality, in spite of all my romanticism, that they would all simply split their sides with laughter, and that the officer would not simply beat me, that is, without insulting me, but would certainly prod me in the back with his knee, kick me around the billiard table, and only then, perhaps, have pity and drop me out of the window. Of course, this trivial incident could not, with me, end in that. I often met that officer afterwards in the street, and noticed him very carefully. I am not quite sure whether he recognized me. I imagine not. I judge from certain signs. But I stared at him with spite and hatred, and so it went on for several years. My resentment grew even deeper with years. At first I began making stealthy inquiries about this officer. It was difficult for me to do so, for I knew no one. But one day I heard someone shout his surname in the street as I was following him at a distance, as though I were tied to him, and so I learnt his surname. Another time I followed him to his flat, and for 10 kopecks learned from the porter where he lived, on which story, whether he lived alone or with others, and so on. In fact, everything one could learn from a porter. One morning, though I had never tried my hand with the pen, it suddenly occurred to me to write a satire on this officer in the form of a novel which would unmask his villainy. I wrote the novel with relish. I did unmask his villainy. I even exaggerated it. At first I so altered his surname that it could easily be recognized, but on second thoughts I changed it, and sent the story to the Otet Chestvenya Zapiski. But at that time such attacks were not the fashion, and my story was not printed. That was a great vexation to me. Sometimes I positively choked with resentment. At last I determined to challenge my enemy to a duel. I composed a splendid, charming letter to him, imploring him to apologize to me, and hinting rather plainly at a duel in case of refusal. The letter was so composed that if the officer had had the least understanding of the sublime and the beautiful, he would certainly have flung himself on my neck and have offered me his friendship. And how fine that would have been! How we should have got on together! He could have shielded me with his higher rank, while I could have improved his mind with my culture, and, well, my ideas, and all sorts of things might have happened. Only fancy, this was 2 years after his insult to me, and my challenge would have been a ridiculous anachronism, in spite of all the ingenuity of my letter in disguising and explaining away the anachronism. But, thank God, to this day I thank the Almighty with tears in my eyes, I did not send the letter to him. Cold shivers run down my back when I think of what might have happened if I had sent it. And all at once I revenged myself in the simplest way, by a stroke of genius. A brilliant thought suddenly dawned upon me. Sometimes, on holidays, I used to stroll along the sunny side of the Nevsky about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, though it was hardly a stroll, so much as a series of innumerable miseries, humiliations, and resentments. But no doubt that was just what I wanted. I used to wriggle along in a most unseemly fashion, like an eel, continually moving aside to make way for generals, for officers of the guards and the hussars, or for ladies. At such minutes there used to be a convulsive twinge at my heart, and I used to feel hot all down my back at the mere thought of the wretchedness of my attire, of the wretchedness and abjectness of my little scurrying figure. This was a regular martyrdom, a continual intolerable humiliation at the thought, which passed into an incessant and direct sensation, that I was a mere fly in the eyes of all this world, a nasty, disgusting fly, more intelligent, more developed, more refined in feeling than any of them, of course, but a fly that was continually making way for everyone, insulted and injured by everyone. Why I inflicted this torture upon myself, why I went to the Nevsky, I don't know. I felt simply drawn there at every possible opportunity. Already then I began to experience a rush of the enjoyment of which I spoke in the first chapter. After my affair with the officer, I felt even more drawn there than before. It was on the Nevsky that I met him most frequently. There I could admire him. He, too, went there chiefly on holidays. He, too, turned out of his path for generals and persons of high rank, and he, too, wriggled between them like an eel. But people like me, or even better dressed than me, he simply walked over. He made straight for them as though they were nothing but empty space before him, and never, under any circumstances, turned aside. I gloated over my resentment watching him, and always resentfully made way for him. It exasperated me that even in the street I could not be on an even footing with him. "Why must you invariably be the first to move aside?" I kept asking myself in hysterical rage, waking up sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning. "Why is it you and not he? There's no regulation about it. There's no written law. Let the making way be equal, as it usually is when refined people meet. He moves halfway, and you move halfway. You pass with mutual respect." But that never happened, and I always moved aside, while he did not even notice my making way for him. And lo and behold, a bright idea dawned upon me. "What," I thought, "if I meet him and don't move on one side? What if I don't move aside on purpose, even if I knock up against him? How would that be?" This audacious idea took such a hold on me that it gave me no peace. I was dreaming of it continually, horribly, and I purposely went more frequently to the Nevsky in order to picture more vividly how I should do it when I did do it. I was delighted. This intention seemed to me more and more practical and possible. "Of course I shall not really push him," I thought, already more good-natured in my joy. "I will simply not turn aside, will run up against him, not very violently, but just shouldering each other, just as much as decency permits. I will push against him just as much as he pushes against me." At last I made up my mind completely. But my preparations took a great deal of time. To begin with, when I carried out my plan, I should need to be looking rather more decent, and so I had to think of my get-up. In case of emergency, if, for instance, there were any sort of public scandal, and the public there is of the most recherché, the Countess walks there, Prince D. walks